Daddy
Dave. Hi, you guys. It's Anna David here with the After Party Pod. Hi. How are you? As this intro is being recorded, I am currently a liquid. I'm melting. Hopefully, by the time you're listening to this, the heat wave is over. I'll tell you a secret about this, too. I mean, it's not quite a secret, but I'll tell you something weird. I love the heat. Nothing's too hot for me. I like New York summers. I spent the month of August in Spain once where it felt like kind of like walking on the sun, both inside and under the sun. And I liked it. And something about this heat is crazy making. And I'm talking the kind of heat where you get in your car and it says 117 degrees and you're not remotely freaked out by that because that's just what it is. I don't know if it's my age. I don't know if it's, I don't know what it is. I'm worried. So if you guys have any explanations or theories or comforting words, please tell me. So my goal lately has been to wear as little clothes as possible. Well, basically to not wear clothes while appearing to be wearing clothes. So I am recording this at home where I am in a nightgown because it's the best clothes-free option, which is not nude, that I could come up with. And that's pretty much what I've been doing as soon as I get home. Find a way to put on no clothes but have clothes on. And so that's weird. Usually I record these in my office. So yeah, that's what's going on with me. Tomorrow I'm going to Alaska, you guys. I'm going to go talk to the kids, the fine young minds at University of Anchorage. Uh-huh. Alaska. I haven't been since I was 10 and I went on a cruise there, which was great fun. But my main interest those days was playing ping pong. So things have changed since then. Like I said, I'm terribly excited. So anyway, it'll all be old news by the time you hear this. And so let me talk about my guest. My guest today is Mick Betancourt. 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 You know this if you downloaded this from iTunes or Libsyn or SoundCloud or wherever you got it. So he is actually, I don't mean to be overly dramatic, like pretty much a walking miracle. This is a guy who had survived one of the more desolate childhoods I've ever heard of. His parents were very young when they had him. His dad died young. I don't want to ruin the story when he tells it, but a lot of chaos, a lot of alcoholism, a lot of abuse. And he's pretty much one of the happiest guys I've ever talked to. And it's not fake. So anyway, he's been sober about 12 and a half years. And, you know, as the cliche goes, he's not just talking the talk, he's walking the walk. And he is a very successful comedian. He is also the host of the Mick Betancourt Show, which you can get on iTunes, a very popular podcast. And as if that is not enough, he's like a super successful TV writer. He doesn't do the comedy thing there. He writes drama. He's written on Chicago Fire. He's written on Law and Order Special Victims Unit. We have a story running on After Party Chat by Danielle Stewart, whom Mick and I talk about a lot in this episode. So when you hear us refer to Danielle, that's who we're talking about. She's faithful After Party Chat listeners, readers, I mean, know that she's one of the main writers for After Party Chat. She's also a previous After Party Pod guest. Anyway, she has a piece that we're publishing on why Law and Order Special Victims Unit binge watching is important for women in sobriety who are going through rough times. So that's about all I can tell you about Mick Betancourt without ruining all the stuff he's about to tell you himself. He's an incredible guy. Go get his podcast. Go watch his TV shows. He's so generous, he gives away t-shirts to the listeners of his podcast. We get into that. He's way more generous than I am. Okay, this is Mick Betancourt.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God, I think my copy has like bloodstains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal, I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
So this podcast may sound a hell of a lot better than the other ones you guys listen to, because Vic just told me about a new sound engineer that is now, he's hired. I haven't met him, but he's hired.
And we're rolling now, I'm assuming.
We're totally rolling. We like cash, right?
I'm in.
You've already, like, you rolled right into this office by the time I saw you.
I was making breakfast when we met.
Yeah. And then you've been cracking Danielle up. Like, what haven't you done here that's casual?
I'm hanging drywall at noon.
You are?
I'm gonna revolutionize the whole office.
Oh, you're doing that? Yeah. I hope that you are a good, like, interior designer, because I still feel like this needs some stuff.
I like your office. This is very cool.
Thank you.
You have to get work done here. It has that vibe to it. Like, we're gonna do some work here.
Yeah. I don't go to environments that aren't like that. Which isn't not that great if you're trying to have fun.
You have a butt on you. I just noticed the green butt you have on your wall.
It's not my butt. It is the best ad. Have you ever seen a better ad for a workout place?
Does that say
Pop Physique?
Oh, Pop.
We're not sponsored by Pop Physique, and in fact,
is
don't.
Is like Pop, like some twerk action? Is that what that's about?
No, that'd be cool. Twerking classes, why don't they have those?
They do.
But, like, that's a workout. Like, you know how they made stripping into a workout?
Yeah. That's what that is?
No, that's something else. It's a really, really hard workout that doesn't make your butt look like that, but it's supposed to.
It could. In a perfect world.
Yeah.
If you did Pop Physique for 14 years straight,
it might look like that.
Starting at the time when you're 18,
yeah,
then you'd have that.
Yeah. It's true. Listeners, you heard it here first. I don't do that workout anymore.
What are you doing now?
I go to this thing called GST that I can't even explain, but it's amazing. You guys, GST Body is the website. It's only in LA, and they teach like 7 classes ever, like a week.
Sounds fascinating.
Do you want to do it? What workout do you do?
I have not worked out, as you can tell.
Can't tell.
In about 6 weeks. Because I had some family shit happen, and I had to slow that roll down. But I love, love, love Barry's Boot Camp. It's probably my favorite workout.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So you actually are a true masochist, not just the...
You know why I like it? And it's not like when I first heard it, I thought it was going to be like people screaming at you, like a boot camp.
He screams.
You know,
I've done
thing.
It.
Really? Not the one that I go to.
Does Barry teach it?
No, it's in, I guess it would be Van Nuys. It's on Ventura Boulevard, just off of Van Nuys, above a cold stone, which is a very tricky, because
yeah.
You walk past the cold
yeah,
stone.
Yeah, that's rough.
I'm not going to lie to you. Sometimes I've actually walked out of the workout and gotten cold stone.
That's almost... You know that they have a policy where they'll give you a free shirt if you throw up there.
Oh, I didn't know. I had a couple yard sales there.
Yeah.
Where I just had to get off the treadmill. Because you know what? I used to wrestle and box, and I love that type
yeah.
of really pushing yourself.
Yeah.
Because if I go to the gym myself now, I just never get there.
Yeah.
I just won't.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. I'm sure I could, but when it's just this group atmosphere and the music's right and someone, at least the ones that I've gone to, the guy wasn't a maniac. He's like, all right, you could do it. It's motivation, you know?
Yeah.
It just feels good. And then when you're done, like, there's that little sense of accomplishment, like, that was fucking hard and I didn't quit, you know?
Totally.
I love that.
But it's when treadmill up to 12, you're going backwards.
Oh, fine. It's insane.
That's when I quit. I had too much of a tangent, but I had a friend who was getting married, and so I agreed to do it with her for a month to prepare. We both gained weight. I mean, we were so famished afterwards. First, we'd go and pass out at class
and then
eat everything in sight.
Sure. That's crazy. That's a great workout, though.
Okay, so having literally the second you came in and interrupted me listening to you on Paul Gilmartin's amazing podcast, it's very surreal to be listening to somebody on this thing and then have them pretty much interrupt you. You were on time. I was unprepared with their real self. Very surreal experience.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever had that when you interview somebody on your podcast.
Sometimes I'll, but that would, you know, it's weird you say that particular podcast because that was... I was in a place where I was listening to Paul's podcast to catch up on, you know, what I was going to listen to. Heard the honesty, Christina Pajinski's podcast, particularly her being very, and our childhoods were very similar.
Right.
So I thought, all right, well, if she's willing to go there and the other guests were, then in fairness, I should too, you know? And so, and plus I was just in a very, I don't know if dark's the right word, but sad, you know?
And
just,
raw.
Let's be fucking raw, exactly. Raw is the best word. Yeah, I was just in a really raw fucking place. So I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. Why?
Yeah.
Not in a self-destructive way, but why shouldn't people be able... There's this weird fallacy, I think, sometimes, of this thing you have to present yourself a certain way all the time.
Yeah.
It's a... I'm sure it's a global thing, but it seems like in LA, New York, you know, in these very image conscious places, a little bit in Chicago, that's something that you have to do. And you know what? Maybe it's because I'm getting a little bit older, maybe because I got a little recovery under my belt. I really don't give a fuck. You know what I mean? I'm an artist. I'm a storyteller at heart. Sometimes I do it comedically. Sometimes I do it dramatically. I really don't fucking care. I'm raising children. I got bigger things to worry about than what you fucking think of me. You know what I mean? My goal is to not be an asshole to you and be a kind person. And then everything outside of that is none of my business.
Well, it's interesting that you say that about the sort of flyover states maybe not being as image conscious, because I think about this all the time in terms of recovery and openness and how lucky we are to have gotten sober in LA, where it's I would almost argue it's the norm. It's so accepted. Mm-hmm. You know, you got sober here.
I tried to get sober in Chicago, and that's where my crew was and like my running partners, and it wasn't it was a little more frigid.
Right.
That's the right word. And it worked. Listen, there's a great sober community in Chicago. It's just what I needed, and I didn't even know I needed it, was to come out here and, you know, get like an attaboy, it's going to be okay, this is possible.
They don't do that in Chicago?
It was a kinder, gentler way.
Right.
Like, without violating any specific traditions for the path that I went down to no longer drink anymore. Sometimes when you're celebrating an anniversary or a birthday, you would call it, you know, and say, out here I've experienced, you know, there's cakes and people sing.
Clapping.
And it's,
you get to give a speech.
And you get to, how did you do it? And, you know, in Chicago, I remember I went back, I had like a year sober. So it's like, so is anybody celebrating a birthday? And you know, Frank, 35 years. All right, good job, Frank. So it was just the, and again, everyone in that room stayed sober that day.
Yeah.
So what do I know?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of different, I guess, if there's a moral of the story, there's a million different ways to find the right path. And it's got to be better for you. You know, it just so happened that the beginning of my path, which I hope goes until they put me in the box, is it started out here.
Yeah. So there you were in Chicago, and you said, well, let's kind of go through it a little. I like chronology.
Let's do it.
Okay. So first started around 8 or 9.
My drinking?
Yeah.
Well, I had my first drink, probably 6.
Do you remember it?
It was a Michelob. And I saw cocaine, and I was I was at a party. My dad was having a party. My parents were 16 and 17 when I was born. My father had custody of me, and we lived in a neighborhood called Humboldt Park in Chicago. And he was a weird kind of, he was a biker. He had long black hair, like turquoise jewelry, always covered in grime from these ship gigs that he had, either in a factory or doing like freelance motorcycle mechanic work. And so it was all like rock, clean, and funk, you know, like Tower of Power and Can Function and Parliament. So the music, and there'd be drugs, and I was a lunatic when I was a kid, you know. And so he gave me a belt buckle, a big Harley Davidson belt buckle, because I was causing like a ruckus at this party. Like, I shouldn't have even been there. I should have been like in a room, like away from the bar. A beer, a bottle of Michelob, and a Playboy.
What's the
and he was like, and he was like, calm down.
Yeah, he knew the formula.
Go in the corner and calm down. So I'm like, all right. So that was like my dad's.
Parenting technique.
He died when he was 22 as a direct result of his alcoholism. But, you know, so he was, I only had him for 6 years. But, you know, that's the type of pain. I can't even imagine my side of 2 children now. Six years. I actually think I was 5. You give me a Playboy and a beer and be like, you gotta fucking calm down. Like, that's even the calming mechanism. Like,
I don't mean to go here right away, but listening to you on the Mental Illness Happy Hour, that almost seems like one of the nicer things.
Yeah.
That happened. You know, he was concerned.
There weren't. I don't think I understood, you know, you hear somebody say, they did the best that they could.
Yeah.
You know, you hear that a lot. In my 20s, I could, that didn't even, that bounced off my ears. That didn't even, it wasn't even getting in.
Yeah.
It did, my ears literally reflected that as pure nonsense and bullshit and rationalization. Then in my 30s, it started to make a little sense. I just turned 40, so it's not like I'm well in my 40s, but thank you. You know, now I have some perspective. Now I actually have lived some life so that I can actually think about somebody other than myself and my own experience as it relates to the world, and now I can start to relate to the world as my experience is a part of that. You know, like I've heard someone say,
yeah,
you know, when you get sober, it's like you go from being the star of a movie with 6 billion extras.
I like that. I've never heard
to,
that.
To, you know.
To like a cameo role.
An ensemble piece.
Yeah.
one of 6 billion ensemble casts. Yeah. But,
I love that.
You know, my mother was sick. She had alcoholism, drug addiction, mental health issues, single mom, totally incapable of almost zero maternal instinct. That's who she was.
Yeah.
You know, so like, it's unfortunate that I got dealt that hand, but I have some perspective on it now. And I believe anybody listening to this, if you feel like there is a way, there are many ways, and they're all accessible, to figure out what your dilemma is if you in fact have one, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you feel jammed up, if you feel twisted, if you feel like, I think the first thing to do, and this is the tricky part, is to be honest with yourself. Because if you're dealing with addiction, either with alcohol, drugs, sex, whatever it is, the addiction is rooted in self-delusion. And the problem with being self-delusional is you're the last to know.
Yeah.
So you have to have the capacity to be honest, which is the trickiest part.
Yeah.
So once you get some awareness and you can say, wow, I have a problem with inappropriate sexual relationships, I have a problem with cocaine, whatever, fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Then you can say, all right, well, I can seek help for this.
Right.
A lot of courage. And fuck other people's definition of courage. I'm telling you right now, it takes courage. You possess that. If you have the capacity to be honest, you also have the capacity to be courageous.
Yeah.
So now you can go, wow, I can go to a meeting and check that out. Oh, that meeting's not right for me. Go to another one. Because we've got one time through this.
Yes.
That's it. And so make it precious. Make it right. Go for it.
I mean, the thing about denial, though, is we can't control it. And it can fade. It can come back.
Absolutely.
It can fade again.
Yeah.
And, you know, they sort of say, there's some very articulate way to phrase this that I can't do, but, you know, something about, you know, the denial lifts at the same moment grace can happen. And that's how people realize they have a problem and can change it.
Absolutely. I think for 100%. And I think if you want to know why you drank, quit drinking. If you want to know why you did cocaine, quit cocaine.
Yeah.
Because once you stop whatever the destructive behavior is, whatever the underlying issues were are going to be glaringly apparent.
Yeah.
And then that's obviously the next stage of whatever your recovery is, because then you can go, oh, I get it. Like in the literature that I read, it says alcohol was just a symptom.
Yeah.
We had to get down to causes and conditions. So, wow, there's causes and conditions I didn't even know. It's very easy to go, I am sad. Childhood.
Yeah.
Makes pudgy sad.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's so easy.
Right.
And part of it is true, but that time has now passed. So how much power do I want to let that have in my life? And more importantly, if I'm talking about recovery and having an abundant, full life that I can enjoy and walk around and look the world in the eye and be at peace, then I have to be concerned about my side of the street. Clean that up so that no matter what, I go, all right, I fucked that person over. I made an amends to them. That's good. We're clean. Mm-hmm. Done. You know? Oh, and it's funny that you talk about that thing coming up. It's going to ebb and flow, delusion, denial. You start to understand what that feels like. So when it happens, you can go, oh, I know what that is. I'm starting to get sucked down the rabbit hole again. And when you're new in recovery down whatever path you're going, that could be weeks or months. Because
right.
You don't know how to get yourself out of it. But I think advanced recovery, if there is such a thing, is it requires less pain to take action.
Yes. Yes. Because you get uncomfortable more quickly.
You don't like the way it makes you feel.
Yeah. But it's interesting, too, you know, having just heard you talk about this sort of voice that says, like, you're a loser, you're lame. And that is, the thing is, you get sober and you get a little paranoid that you're ignoring problems. I do.
Mm.
And so then that voice starts to seem real. in a way.
Yeah.
What do you think that voice is about?
Well, I think to even acknowledge the voice, because some people won't even acknowledge that voice exists, and it's like when you're having a conversation with yourself, there are two people talking.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way that it is. Mm-hmm. So just imagine when you're talking to yourself, you're talking to two people. Mm-hmm. Who's that other person?
Mm-hmm.
That's a legit thing that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a divided consciousness. To me, that's my drinking partner.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been my drinking. I live with my drinking partner. That person was there when all of the friends, in quotes, friends left. And
mm-hmm.
it was once again me alone
mm-hmm.
in my own depravity of shame and remorse. Once again, after a 3 or 4 day run, toxic, horrible, broken, just me and my drinking partner.
Yeah.
That's my voice.
Yeah.
And the pitch is always, that this is going to be fun. This is going to work out. This will make things better.
Yes.
This is the right thing to do. And so I'll listen, and then I'll start to follow that down, and that's always the great bait. And this is what I hang my hat on, and hopefully this answers your question. If I knew how to control and manage my life, and I've survived some shit, right?
Yeah.
So I have gotten through some things, so this is why it gets tricky for me. Well, you made it through that other shell. Clearly you can survive. Clearly you know how to. That those things that used to work no longer work. They got me through those situations, and then they stopped. Just like alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
What I thought were assets have turned into liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Again, capacity to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
All right, those things no longer work. I cannot rely on those tools to work for me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the presentation of that may be to the contrary. So, now I'm veering, but the point is to just go, I can't sit across from you right now and say, you know, by the end of today, I'm going to be victorious. I'm going to leave here and assemble a sequence of events and actions in my day that will guarantee me happiness, fiscal and emotional success.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know what's best for me, and I'm going to go out and do that.
Mm-hmm.
There's how I trip myself.
Mm-hmm.
And people listening might be going, are you a fucking lunatic? That's exactly what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
That's what got me drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I knew how to do that, I would have seen alcohol and drugs as a liability, said that's toxic and bad for me, clapped my hands together and said, thank God, I know that, it's bad for me, and I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm powerless.
Right.
And I believe that stuff that it says in the various literatures of lack of power is my dilemma.
Yes.
I believe that.
Right.
And with all the best intentions in the world, I will leave here and I will try to control and manage my life and somehow seem disappointed. It'll somehow be insufficient. And I'll be confused by around 11 tonight of what happened. I
mm-hmm.
really wanted this to be a great day. I had such great plans. I
mm-hmm.
had such great ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here I am feeling lonely, discontent, and confused.
Yeah, and so the best way to do that is to... I mean, here's the confusing part a little bit, because I do think attitude makes a huge difference.
Sure.
So how do you get up in the morning and go, okay, I can control this, and yet I can because my perception can be off otherwise.
My previous run might have sounded a little preachy, so I want
to... You want an addendum?
Well, an addendum, it's just like, you know, but in all honesty, that's... I believed what I just said, and it sounds very rote, but for me, when my manic mind starts chomping at my day and trying to motivate me to get going and win at the game of life, that's... I need very simple slogans and phrases that hit the brakes on that.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what I do. I believe in a God,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I turn my life and my will over to the care of God. Half your listeners just turn this podcast off.
No, they're used to it.
That is not attached to any religion, organized religion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't even really quantify or tell you who or what that God is, other than if I had to, you know, if you had a gun to my head and you said, how could you sum it up, please, because you can't just be that mysterious about it, I would have to say, love and kindness.
Mm-hmm.
So I turn my life and care,
mm-hmm.
my life and will, over to the care of love and kindness. The power of love and kindness, which I believe is my dumb, human, frail mind, is that's the closest I can get to the concept of God. Without robes, swinging urns of incense,
right.
kneeling...
Buddha statues.
What, all of that.
So you don't kneel?
I kneel in the morning as a physical reminder to myself that I am not in charge.
Do you, does an image come to your head at all when you do that?
Bud Abbott. No.
I don't even know who that is.
You know who Abbott and Costello is?
Come on. Okay, well, if you said Abbott of Abbott and Costello, I would have known.
I'm pretty proud of Abbott.
My, I have a sponsee whose chair is her higher power.
Her chair? Oh, chair?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's great. And yeah. I know a lot of people be like, you can't do that because whatever. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
You can do whatever you want. That's the beautiful part about it.
Yeah.
If it works for you, go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And my idea of who and what God is has changed through my entire sobriety. It changed from the time that I was a kid. You know, I was an altar boy. I was raised in a fairly rigid Catholic environment. I went to Catholic grade school. I went to an all-boys Catholic Dominican brother prep school. I went to Jesuit college. So, you know, there was some...
But yet I just heard you talk about, too, that when your grandfather died and you said, there is no God.
Well, when he died... Yeah, that was when I went into a church and I went onto the altar and I spit on the crucifix. And I paused waiting for a fist to come crashing through the roof and literally put me out like a cigarette. And when nothing happened, I just kind of laughed to myself like, yeah, this is all a fucking sham. And even if it isn't, fuck you.
Right
to the cross. Fuck you, you piece of shit. You just took the one fucking thing that I had. You took. There's nothing more that you can do to me. There's not, you've taken everything. And now I lived on my own for the next year.
And now that's just where I was in your story. Okay, can we go back to chronology? Okay, so you have that Michelob, you get the Playboy. Do you even know, like, is the Playboy exciting?
I don't know one that isn't.
At six?
Well, you know, there were some things that happened in that house that, tragically, certainly at the time, sexually with some other people in the house. So I was exposed to that stuff much earlier than I probably should have been. So
yeah.
I kind of understood what the various parts were used for.
And that was exciting on a certain level.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, as a matter of fact, I had, you know, because you're a kid, I just opened the Playboy up at the party and I just started humping, you know, the beer was on one side. I took the belt buckle off. And I was just humping the Playboy. And, you know, then I heard laughter and I looked up and there were like a half moon of people just cracking up. They were all teenagers, too, and like in their early 20s. So they thought it was the funniest shit ever. So my dad grabbed me and, you know, gave me a spanking. And he's like, now you got to go to fucking bed.
Yeah.
And I look back now and I like how insane all of it was of like, you know, after he puts me to sleep, that like was like one of his friends like, man, I don't understand what happened. You gave him a beer and you gave him the Playboy. I mean, what else do you do with a kindergartner when you want to just like, it's all so fucking weird.
Oh my God.
So, yeah.
And so then it was, alcohol was very accessible, but it sounds like you were your mom's designated driver a lot.
You know, what's weird is alcohol was mysterious and destructive. Like I watched it destroy my dad's side of the family, and I moved in with my mom, and she would take me out drinking with her. So I would be out at bars, you know, at 9 or 10, drinking Manhattans with her till 1 or 2 in the morning, and then whichever one of us could drive the best would drive home.
The fact that you were not of age to drive was never a concern.
No, even at my uncle's wedding, my grandfather, who I later found out was sober, had relapsed twice. One was at my uncle's wedding.
Mm.
Both he and my mom were so drunk that I was one of the ring bearers.
Yeah.
And I was driving the station wagon home, and I was pretty okay on the streets, but I had never driven on the highway before. So we started to go on the highway, and I really started to freak out. And I'm like, I don't think I can do this. Like... And my mom's like, just fucking, you know, this is rough, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
And so she's swearing, she's hitting me, like, just fucking do it. And I'm like, shaking and crying. I'm like, I think I'm going to crash. And so she was so pissed that she had to drive. My grandfather was passed out.
Oh, my God.
In the side seat. But that's the only, I saw him drink. Well, I only saw him drink once, but I know he went out twice. One time he went down. He had this mistress that used to fly up. The one that broke up his marriage, he saw until they put him in the box. But One time he flew down to Florida to spend some time with her, and he relapsed there. And basically, she was watching her boss. She was like an executive assistant. She was watching her boss's mansion, like down in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And my grandfather, he was a stunning, handsome guy, big, used to be. I'll tell you that story, but because I don't want to ruin this one. So anyway, he starts drinking. Early times was his drink. And he's like a lunatic. And he thinks, you know, when you get paranoid when you're drinking, you know, she's fucking
the
this
boss,
guy. And it's a whole thing. And so she starts hitting him with a fucking frying pan.
Mm-hmm.
And broke his nose and cut open the side of his thing. And my uncle had to go and grab him and get him on a plane. And he was, you could just see him so broken. Like, you know, because mm-hmm. he called it going to the club. So we go to the club every day, which I know. I'm a member of the club.
Right.
So, you know, you sit around and play cards. It was like a clubhouse that we'd have meetings. And so when he died, this is now going back in chronological order. So going back. Actually, no. He went out, so this is later. So when he died...
he had to go out before he died.
Yeah, he
died. I know that.
He was not a mythical ghost beast. I was at his wake where they had the open casket. And I was in the back. And I was pretty much cried out. I just was so... It happened so quickly. He had a heart attack. And... this old lady, like 80, right? I mean, just frail old woman, black patent leather purse and shoes and the black mourning veil, comes and sits right next to me. Like, I'm way in the back. There's probably 25 rows of chairs that she could have gone in. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? I'm in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And other people are up saying they're Our Fathers and Hail Marys in front of the casket. And she comes and she sits next to me and she puts her hand on my leg and she goes, "Your grandfather was the most dashing gangster I had ever seen." And then she just gets up and she walked out. And I'm like, "What?" And it turns out when he was a younger guy, he was a no-fuck-around gangster.
A real life.
Ran guns with this other guy who I won't say his name even though he's passed away. And
like a name we know.
Fish only gets caught if it opens its mouth.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to be responsible for that.
No, he's long since passed.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. I don't want to slander anybody.
Yeah.
I'm not really slandering my grandfather, but it just was once again in this weird, you know, I'm kind of bouncing around here to answer your very simple question.
Which was, I don't remember.
How accessible was alcohol?
Yeah.
I saw alcohol as a release for people, then I saw it destroy their lives, and there were all these secrets. But alcohol was always married, was always side by side to this brutal chaos
mm-hmm.
and this kind of two-dimensional perceived elation.
Mm-hmm.
It was fantasy. It was not real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was all this hope and excitement as people were drinking. Right,
mm-hmm.
The world's going to be great. We're going to get out of here. I'm going to go back to school. As the drinks are going
mm-hmm.
down, and then once pure intoxication started. Misery arrived,
mm-hmm.
resentment arrived, physical abuse arrived. You know, it all switched, it all turned on a dime. So that, you know, halfway there was tremendous hope and excitement, and then the fucking wheels just came off.
Right.
That's how I saw alcohol. And so I was around it, but it was like a double-edged sword. One was, don't ever do this, and then one was like, here, have a drink with me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a...
Did people actually say, don't ever do this, or you saw that?
Oh, my grandfather said, listen, whatever you do, you're going to stay away from the drink and cigarettes. He told me that one night. And you know, it's so weird when you start unpacking all this shit. In like a therapy session, I felt so like there was this one... I kept saying, like, I'm sorry. This kink thing kept repeating in my head, like, I'm sorry. I didn't know what I was apologizing for, you know? And it turns out one night we were on a walk. I was, like, 9. And he made me give him my word that I would never drink or smoke. And I did. I gave him my word. And I feel like I violated my word, you know? And being from Chicago... Right or wrong, you know, your word is your honor, and that's it. And you give your fucking word, and that's all you have, because money's going to come and go. Some years you buy the jewelry, some years you sell it.
Right.
But you got your word is your honor. And I never knew that particular conversation had that much power in my life, that I had really meant it that much and felt that I had betrayed him and myself. And, you know, just one little nugget as we're trudging this path of recovery to realize, wow, I'm just not 100% aware of all of the things at play in my life.
Right. How old were you when you remembered that?
A weird thing happened to me when I was, let's see, my son's 11, so when he was 6. So I could write a story about a guy who knows about numbers, but...
So that was, as far as I'm concerned, you're a number genius. Because you remembered the time that I had said you should have been.
When my son was 6, we were singing Happy Birthday to him. And I was holding a cake that had the number 6 on it that was lit. And I was holding it out for him to blow the candle. And I saw how small he was. And something snapped in my brain where I thought, I could not have been that size. Like, I wasn't that little. Like, he's so little, you know? He's so tiny. And I couldn't get my head around the fact that the things that had happened to me started when I was that, actually a year prior, but really, like, really started going at 6. Because in my memories, I'm this size.
Yeah.
You know, I'm
5'8",
210 right now.
Right.
So it's like, if you want to fuck around, we'll go.
Right.
We'll go, and we're both going to get hurt, but we'll go. I'll go.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's no, it doesn't just happen now. I can stand up for myself.
Yeah.
So this little weird, bing, like a little wire just came loose. And it got worse and worse and worse and worse until I had to go see a therapist and discover what all these things were, that just because I made it through something does not mean necessarily that that's over. But it's amazing how long I had convinced myself that that was the case. Like, move through, move around, whatever you got to do to get past it, to get, you know, rarely through it, you're most likely around it.
Yeah.
Which seems like an insignificant difference, but it's a profound difference. If you get through something, then you're through it. It has a beginning, middle, and an end. Whereas if you go around it, it's still going to be waiting for you.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a matter of time or when it comes back to haunt you. I didn't know that, though.
Had you never been in therapy before then?
I had DCFS came. They were going to take me out of the house a couple times. I had social workers, priests, counselors, for sure. But there really wasn't I was such in survival mode that it was, I'd be very delicate about what I said. Because, you know, I knew there was a world where if I fully confessed is the wrong word, if I fully shared what was happening, mm-hmm. then I would get taken out of my house. And I knew that foster care or even becoming a ward in the state would probably be worse than where I was at.
Mm-hmm.
So it was I had to kind of parcel out truths mm-hmm. in order to just kind of get by day to day for a long period of time until I was probably 16. Really 18, but 16 for sure.
And so did the parceling out make you able to compartmentalize what happened in almost that denial way?
Yeah. I mean, there were just such other fundamental things of, like, eating. You know, like, it wasn't like, you know, when I was 14, I panhandled for a little, most of that summer to eat.
Yeah.
I would steal food. You know, it was rough. And then I moved in with some family members that did the best they could, but we had to steal to eat because there were even more of us. And then we wound up moving back into the place that I had just moved out of.
But you painted. You painted and sold paintings for a
while. I did, yeah. I couldn't. I was... That brought up... Yes, man, it's a shameful thing, man, to beg for money. So it's just rough. I have such compassion for people that are in that spot because it's just... There's nothing... I know some people get a job. Like,
yeah.
Okay. It's like, what are you going to do? You're going to walk into a business? And, I mean, sure, there is a world where that's possible, but you're talking about an emotional state that is so depraved and frail, and it's so intense. I can't even tell you.
Yeah. I mean, out of all the stuff that you talk about from your childhood, it almost seems like that's the one that resonates as the most painful.
Kind of, just because there's a sense of being so alone.
Yeah.
That, like, even if you're hitting me and I know you, well, I know you. Like, at least there's some connection. As perverse and as insane as that sounds, and stock home syndrome-y.
Yeah, yeah.
At least there's a connection there. At least the hand that's hitting me is connected to somebody that might sometime in the future or possess a memory for me in the past that brings me some kind of a smile or a grin.
Right.
Whereas being on a corner, having people look at you like you're a piece of shit is rough. There's no hope in that. There's just nothing. It's like, I need a dollar to eat.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like it. It's not a want situation. It's a need situation that's not being met.
Right.
So it's not like I want a new toy or I want, like, there's a, it's moment to moment panic and terror, because even when I get this, I know that I'm going to have to do it again.
Yeah.
It's not. So you're off this normal track of living and feeling fine, and it breaks something in you
yeah.
know? Something just snaps.
And so when you started drinking, you know, when you got a career going as a drinker, Danielle told me that, like, it was, this is what she told me this morning, that when comics were performing with you,
mm-hmm.
they would say, yeah, can I go on early? Because, you know, I kind of got to get out of here before he gets going.
Did they really say that? I never even heard
that. That's what she told me.
Why was it? Because I was...
Because you just got so crazy. She didn't specify what crazy meant.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wasn't drinking to calm down. I was drinking for the crazy, to be honest with you. Like, the Beat Poets and the Thoreau and the Marrow of Life. Like, to me, I saw that as my ticket. It was my fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew what life was like if I didn't drink. It was, I didn't know I was an alcoholic at the time. I didn't know what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know that I had a disease of perception, that I was chronically dissatisfied. It was my default mode. And so that, like, kind of wrenching feeling in my gut was part of a larger issue.
Right.
And so if that's what I'm getting in just being sober, why would I want to exist that way? If I don't even understand what that is, I don't want to feel that way, you know?
Yeah.
And I knew that drinking was this rocket ship ride, like Burroughs' Inner Zone, even though I never done heroin. Just like this, I wanted it to be chaotic. I wanted there to be good stories. I wanted there to be this larger-than-life. Not like I was trying to create a larger-than-life persona. I wanted to lead a larger-than-life
yes.
thing. That's what I wanted to experience, you know? And so, when I first... I only drank out here for 6 months, which is so weird. Like, but I tried to push a car off of... like, I heard about Mulholland Drive.
Oh, yeah.
And so I had a Kia rental car, and I told this kid, I go, take me up to Mulholland. And so we go up to Mulholland, like, 4 a.m, and I'm like, all right, come on. And so I open the car up, and I'm pushing it. And he's like, what are we doing? He's on the other side. Like, we're pushing it like it's out of gas. I put it in neutral. He goes, what the fuck are we doing? I go, I want to launch it off the cliff here and see if it blows up A-team style. Let's see if we can fucking get the thing to go.
Because you had insurance on it, or you didn't even care. Yeah.
So he's like, what are you talking about? So he jumps in, and he pushes the emergency brake down. He's like, I'm not walking all the way back down the fucking hill. He didn't give a shit about the car.
Yeah.
I didn't even know there were houses down there.
Uh-huh.
Like, I just thought it was a cliff, you know? Uh-huh. I'm like, let's launch it off and see what happens. I said, dude, we can't do that. I was just telling her before we sat down, there was a guy at the Improv, Patrick Keaton, was on stage, and I was sitting on a stool at a table, and there was a bench that ran along the wall. So it was a bench, the table, and then stools on the outside facing the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy kept tapping my stool. He was sitting on the bench.
Oh, wait. You told this on a podcast. Go on.
Oh,
I've
yeah.
I've heard this.
So I'm like, hey, man, can you not tap my stool? And he's like, yeah, sorry. And he starts tapping it again. I'm like, dude, come on. Like, I can feel it when you're tapping.
Yeah.
My stool is like, I'm on the bench. I keep slipping. I'm like, then put your feet on the floor, man. So then he starts kicking my stool, and I threw the table.
Yeah.
And then I just started kicking the fuck out of the guy. I'm like, how the fuck do you... And I'm not that guy. I'm not... it sounds hypocritical saying I'm not the guy while I'm being
the
guy.
Sorry.
But...
You didn't do that all the time.
I didn't do it all the time. I don't like losing my temper. I don't think I do it almost. That's probably the only time in LA that I've done it. I did jump out of my car one time when a Hummer went around me and almost hit an old lady crossing the crosswalk, which is why I was stopped. But his dumb Hummer brain couldn't get around the idea that
the old lady needed to not die.
Yeah, so I got out and I tried to punch his car, and he took out so I couldn't hit it. So two times in 12 years. I'll take that. Yeah. I've been here for 12 years. So, but I drank, like my drink was a pint glass of Bombay Sapphire and tonics with two limes and a shot of tequila. And so I would guzzle half the pint glass, do the shot, smoke a cigarette, guzzle the other half, and then order another round.
That's efficient.
And so that was towards the end. And so I was drinking probably a bottle of Bombay a day and half a bottle of tequila, probably minimum.
Jesus. And this is like taking a tangent from the least interesting aspect of that story. But okay, I remember when you told that story on your podcast, you talked about how people eating drives you crazy, like the noises, like that tapping and all that stuff.
Yeah, like if
just
someone's
trigger
chewing
response.
Gum
yeah.
right next to me, or if they're chewing like...
Oh my God, don't even do that. Yeah.
Open, I'm like, are you a fucking animal? Like, I can't... It's so funny because I get on my kids a lot, and my son's got braces, so I've taken it like a little easier with him. But I still... like, in our house was a black family when I was a kid, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought I was black until I was 7. I talked like a little black kid.
Yeah.
I looked like a black kid. So when my dad died, my uncle came and got me out of the hood, moved me over in with my mom. My mom had a very strict beat the black out of me program.
Yeah.
She's like, any dialect that I had, I would just get open hand, whack, whack, just literally beat the black out of me. Then once the black was beaten out of me, it was like, that's how I know, man, you know. Whack, whack. So like I have these, and it still drives me nuts. Like
yeah.
Obviously the beat the black, I don't give a fuck about, but that noise still is such an old idea in my head, and it's like nails on chocolate.
I have the same thing. I have no excuse.
Oh,
but like
grotesque.
My brother would do this thing where he would gulp, like he would sip less. Hot chocolate, and he still does it to drive me crazy. It's like,
ugh, no.
And if people are chewing gum, it happens to me like 3 or 4 times a week. Are you okay on
everything? Yeah.
I just try to passive aggressively stop them. So what I'll do, I'll just give that look, like in a meeting. It just happened the other day. People will like someone will be doing it, and I'll just look back at them like in shock and horror, like they're hitting someone, and then they'll stop for a while, and then I just like do it again when they start up again. Have you ever tried that?
When someone chews gum with their mouth open,
oh god,
it's over 18. I think they might be Al Qaeda. Like, you're a fucking terrorist. Like,
yeah.
And I know it sounds horrible that I'm.
but you're like, describing it well,
like
at the same time.
It's such an egregious violation. It's like sneezing right in someone's face without putting your hand over your mouth.
That's better. That's better than the chewing, as far as I'm concerned.
It's so disrespectful for the people that are around
you.
You know what I mean? Like, and I'll take, if that's the shit that really gets me going, I feel like I'm on the right side of shit.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Of all of the things that could be wrong that I'm letting slide to not get me amped up. But there's that, oh.
But I have like a trigger response. It's just like it doesn't make sense.
You throw the mean mug stare?
I do the stare. I will instruct friends. You know, just kind of like, here's the thing. I have a huge problem with that. I will, not date a guy. If I like him and he does that, oh, too bad.
If he
like,
slurps?
Like, let's say I go on a date with a guy. The slurping is one thing, but the gum chewing, I'm just like, I can't really, it's not really.
It's horrible. It's
can't date an active alcoholic, can't date a gum chewer.
Active alcoholic. Will you date somebody in recovery?
Yeah, and I have. I wouldn't say it's been a raring success, but not that dating active alcoholics has been a raring success either.
That's rough, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, it's alcoholics, even in its sobriety, is a lot of alcoholics.
But that pretty much qualifies you for Al-Anon.
Do you
just the relationship alone?
Your wife is not one of us, as they say.
No, she was my drinking partner for a long time.
Really?
And then she got, and I didn't even know this was a thing. But you know how like when you're at a bar and there's two sinks, one soapy water for the pitchers, and then the other one they rinse the pitchers in just regular water.
Yeah.
I guess if you don't really rinse the soap out, a bacteria can grow in the soap, and she got it like in her liver and kidney, and she was in the ICU. We were in our 20s, when this happened. She was in the ICU for like 3 or 4 days. And it was almost like her body created its own anabuse.
Yeah.
Because every time she drank after that, she would just get sick.
Oh my God.
So she just stopped drinking. She's like, every time I drink, I get sick. Why would I do that? But she like, she could go toe-to-toe with me drinking. Like.
And she doesn't need to do recovery or anything like that. You know, who knows? Not my business.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway. No, I, you know, that's on her. But I mean, if I had to guess, I'd probably say no.
Yeah.
You know.
So, okay, so when you were tearing it up, what Danielle was referring to was not lots of fights. You were just, like, trying
to... I was never a big fighter, although, because I came from a really intense, like, a lot of screaming and a lot of breaking shit and a lot of hitting stuff, I created a persona, like a tough guy persona. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been in a handful of fights, but, like, I wrestled,
yeah,
which I loved, and I got involved as a teenager with a group of people that were very tough. And because I knew I wasn't very sure which way my life was going to go.
Yeah.
So I thought, if I'm going to be on the street, then I'm not going to be in the middle or the lower end of that spectrum. I'm going to be a shot caller so that I can. I'm not going to survive this bullshit in the house to be on the street to then get more of it. Fuck that. You know what I mean? So. I wound up being the leader of this crew when I was about 15 and 16, and it was a group of tough kids, and then one kid decided that I should die, I was going to die. I was about a block. I got tipped off 2 blocks away from where I was about to get killed, and I just walked away from that completely. So, but the reason why I bring that up is almost all those kids were probably tougher than I was. But I was the head guy for a reason, because I wasn't the toughest one. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to be on the wrong end of that equation. Mm-hmm. So I felt like if I control my image and people think I'm tough, they just won't mess with me. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's probably what she's talking about, because I brought a lot of that out from Chicago with me, because I saw a lot of weakness. You know, I was still drinking for 6 months. I saw a lot of weakness, a lot of phony bullshit, and I'm like, I'm going to walk all over this, you know what I mean? I'm going to bulldog this.
Yeah.
That old drinking mentality of like we first started talking about, I'm going to control this.
Yes.
I'm going to make this the way that I want.
Yes.
And it's tricky out there, because a lot of people think, and they get away with it, and they find much success at, like, this is who I want people to think that I am.
Yeah.
Because it's show business.
Yeah.
You know, we're in show business, the entertainment industry, and I have found my path to success as being, authentic, you know, being honest.
Well, and a path to peace, because
absolutely,
that breaks down inside, you know, the 3 a.m. or whatever.
Yeah.
So when did you decide you wanted to be a comic? Or were you a writer first?
No, well, I was a writer first. Well, I wrote first, and I believe that writers write. You know, I write for free. I get paid to take notes. Mm-hmm. So that's how I view my career as a writer. Like, I'll write something and then someone pays me, but they give me notes. So I'm getting paid to take those notes.
Yeah, that's
so
interesting.
So I do open mics for free. I do sets for free. So when I perform comedy for commerce, it's someone telling me, we like that joke, we don't like that joke. So I'm doing comedy for notes.
Yeah.
And I'm taking adjustments.
Yeah.
So I was writing in grade school, and I was writing in high school, and I started doing stand-up. I started doing Second City and stand-up in my early 20s, and then I've been doing stand-up now for about 18 years. I just put out an album, shit, about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
I made it available for free on my website for 7 days, and then I just took it down.
That's it? Why did you do that?
Just felt like the right thing to do.
And you definitely have, you know, I've heard you talk in your podcast about how people have come to you wanting to advertise, and you won't.
No, I won't.
and yet, you give away t-shirts on the regular, so that's probably a significant expense.
Yeah, I gave away probably 2,000 t-shirts so far. All over the world. It's great. It's great.
I mean, it's brilliant marketing, too. But
well, do I want to go and reach out to Crackle, let's say, and give them $5,000 to advertise for a little quarter for a day, right? And put a little Nick Betancourt Show podcast button click fucking nonsense on their site. Or say, wow, You guys listen to my show, I want to invest in you.
Crackle, if you're listening, I'm open to advertising. I mean, I
Crackle's
find it
great, by the
really
way. They're doing, I mean, I'm just using that as a site that would fit the, you know, the, you know, that's a cool site that has an eclectic, or Rolling Stone, you know, like something that's got a wide palette of, because the log line of my podcast is half comedy, half drama, all heart. Because I've been doing stand-up for 18 years, I've been writing dramatic television for 10, and I really want to have the through line of both those things be the heart that drives that, you know? So I feel like those would be good examples, even though Crackle's like a perceived, almost like a Mad Magazine type of thing.
By the way, I was picturing the candy bar. I was picturing Crackle.
No, Crackle, the website, they're doing original, you know, they're doing original content now. They have some great writers on there that are writing some great, like, essays and fictional pieces. It's actually a really cool site. But that was just an example of taking a contemporary thing that most people go, that's what I want to advertise on. You know, I want to piggyback on their views. But, you know, if I have 10 people listening to me, it's my honor to send them shirts. And then if they're cool enough to wear my shirt, then it's a relationship. Yeah. It's just not me going, all bow before me and then run out and talk about me and then come back and I'll talk some more. I don't know. I just think the evolution of the entertainment of what we're doing now is a little past that. The emails that you get for this are probably very personal about people talking. And that's amazing. And I think that, look, Fatty Falls Down, very funny. Always be there. Cars turning into robots, shooting each other out in space, always be there. Phenomenal entertainment, great ticket. But now there's room for this.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm down for. And I think this will take care of itself. Whatever my podcast is supposed to be is none of my business. I show up, I be of service to that. I want to have, when it's funny, it's funny. When it's sad, it's sad. Let it be what it is and let the people enjoy that. You know what I mean? And then it'll take care of itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's an act of faith.
I hope so.
Forget the kneeling, you know? And so you started doing Second City and performing, and you found success quickly or easily?
No way. I found, like, I think you can, success varies. Like, if you're doing stand-up and you can get up at the shows that you want that don't pay, but they're just the shows where there's an audience and people who are doing comedy that you respect and admire, and then you could share the stage with them, I think that's a version of success, certainly, you know? And so you're accepted by your peers. You can get stage time when you need it. That was my first version of success. Like, oh, this guy's funny. We would want him on the show. No money, just like acceptance, I guess. Creative acceptance, you know? So that's the first acceptance that I found. And then I did the Chicago Comedy Festival in 2001 and got offered to be represented by an agent out here. And it's so funny that we're having this conversation today because, tragically, 9/11 was yesterday. Yes. Today's the 12th. But I quit my day job the morning of 9/11. And I wasn't sure if I was going to do it. I wasn't sure if I was going to move out to L.A. And I watched the second plane go into the tower in Chicago. And I had an epiphany because I was raised, you know, my grandfather was an immigrant. My father's father was an immigrant, was from Puerto Rico. My grandfather, my mom's father was from, actually born in Scotland, but was Irish. And told me, you know, this is the greatest country in the world, and you can do anything that you want. Is you find the hardest working guy you know and work twice as hard as him, and all your dreams will come true. Now, I've already shared some shit that happened to me, you know, so I was like, fuck, man, this. But I knew that the idea of America was greater than I, that they weren't lying, that they weren't fucking around, because I knew where they had come from.
Yeah.
And that my grandfather had a two flat. Like, how did, he had a similar story being a poor kid like me. And when he died, he had a two flat, you know? And the Puerto Rican side was a little more broken because heroin was involved. But so I'm not personalizing that tragedy, but I was inspired by it. I said, fuck this. Fuck this attack right now. I am an American, and this sounds corny, but I was working at the airport when they were starting to bring planes down, landing all the planes. It was total chaos. And I went into the human resources department, and I said, I'm quitting. And they go, today's the wrong day to do that.
Yeah.
And I go, no, today's the right day.
Wow.
And they said, take a leave of absence because you have an amazing job, and you're going to go to L.A. Because I said, I told them what I'm doing. I go, I'm moving to L.A. And they said, you're going to fail. Basically, you know, they're like, look, millions of people go there, they fail. Just keep the door open here so that if you need your job back, it'll be here when you're done. And I said, if I do that, then I'll always know it's here waiting for me, and I don't think I'll ever, I can't have any safety nets.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, all right. And she said, once you sign this, this job's gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed it, and as soon as the planes got up,
you came out here.
I came out to LA.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then when did you start writing television?
2006 is, I booked a pilot in 2005 as a dramatic actor, which is weird. I did stand up on TV a couple times, like on Comedy Central and NBC, which is my first success as a comedian, mm-hmm. you know, or my first TV spots.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't book any half hour roles as an actor. I wound up booking these roles as like a cop, a detective, a bad guy on 1 hour, or a gangster. And so I booked this pilot and it never went. And so, but I talked to the writer of the pilot and I said, listen, man, I have an idea for this show. I don't want you, like, I'm not hustling you
mm-hmm.
to have you, like, do anything with it, but can you just tell me if I should pursue it? Because I don't have any experience in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to lunch. I told him, and he said, this is fucking great. I'll go out with you with that.
Oh, my God.
And that's what I said. I go, I don't even know what does that mean? Like, because yeah. I had never sold anything, or I didn't know. I was totally unfamiliar with the process. So we went in, we talked to the deal, you know, we had a deal with the production company, they liked it, then we went into the studio and they liked it, then we went to the network, and they bought it in the room.
Oh my God.
So I was like, wow, this is incredible. And so we co-wrote this pilot, they never shot it, but yeah. that was my foot in the door. And then, because we co-wrote it, I needed to write an original piece.
On your own.
On my own. And so I did that, and since 2006, I got hired on the Black Donnellys. That was my first staffing show, and that went for 13, and then got canceled. And then the year after that, I got hired on Law and Order SVU, and I did 3 seasons on that. So since 2006, I've been working consistently as a dramatic writer.
Are you on a show right now?
I'm a consulting producer for Chicago PD. Yeah,
nice.
On NBC.
Consulting producer sounds like a real big gig.
It's very nice. Yeah, I've worked. I also took it very specifically because the way contracts work right now is you can't develop. So I couldn't go out and pitch. Say you and I had an idea for a show. I couldn't go out and pitch it. I'm exclusive to whatever that show is, and also the studio that's producing the show. So I took a consulting gig so that I could actually go out and then try to sell my own stuff again this year. So next week I'll be pitching a show of a boom comic that I'm developing for a show. I'll probably pitch it to Fox and NBC. So I'm super stoked.
Because like the being a comic and then writing for these dramatic shows is an interesting dichotomy.
I rarely tell people in the drama world that I do stand-up, mm-hmm. and then I rarely tell people in the stand-up world that I do that I write, which is so funny because I've actually had comics that didn't know, in New York as a matter of fact, come in and audition, and then I was, you know, if I was producing the episode, I'd be,
mm-hmm.
and they're like, what the fuck are you doing here?
You friends with someone here?
Yeah, and I'm like, and then I would pause the casting session so that they wouldn't be caught off guard. And
yeah.
I'd say, come down a couple things. You know, I'm going to bump it down the list 3 or 4 times, reset, go
yeah.
in. And then I tell them, you know, this is what they're looking for, or what I'm looking for, actually.
So weird.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
To the point that when I was, you know, looking you up, I was like, Danielle, it's so weird. There's someone with the same exact crazy name who's a TV writer. And she's like, no, that's him.
Yeah. It's I keep everything on. I know a lot of people like to ring the bell and be like, look at all the shit I've done.
Yeah.
I just like, I don't know. I want to just serve whatever the project is that I'm working on, and that's it.
You know, this is going back slightly, but so what I think is very interesting is growing up the way you grew up, you know, having to be on the streets panhandling, and that your attitude about money is all this, let me actually spend money on my podcast instead of making money on my podcast.
Yeah.
What do you think that's about?
Well, I want to say two things. So, although that time in my life of panhandling was very profound and had a very deep effect on my life, I don't want to make it seem like Oliver Twist where I was out for a long period of time, which, oddly enough, made it even more confusing to have it be wedged in between being able to eat, and then all of a sudden the wheels came off, and then, you know what I mean? Like,
yes,
it was even more surreal. So I just didn't want it to seem like it was, you know, there were times where there was Christmas and there were presents under the tree. Like, it was just a weird...
But it was never, like, the lap of luxury.
Oh, no. But I didn't want to make it seem, just in fairness, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To the story. But the reason why I like investing money in... I think it's the right thing to do. I just think it's the right thing to do. And I don't have... I have a hardcore group of people that listen to my show all over the world, and it's between me and them. And anybody else that discovers the show then comes into that fold. Mm-hmm. And there's no... Like, I'm not hoping to get a TV show out of it.
Right.
I'm not... I'm hoping that, like Steve Simone's coming by it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Great guy. I really think he's funny. Catholic from Philadelphia, and he wears his Catholicism on his sleeve. And I don't see that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, you seem to have a really fundamental, sound relationship with your Catholicism in a city like L.A., where you're out every night at the Comedy Store,
mm-hmm.
which is the den of fucking depravity.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like? And I'm fascinated by that story. So I want to serve that story. And then whatever happens from that will be what's supposed to happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, once I surrendered, which came from the path of recovery, the idea of money, which was had been hurting me my entire life, I surrendered that I would do whatever the next right indicated thing was in my life,
mm-hmm.
and accept that as that was what I was supposed to be doing, that I would be taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I meant fundamental needs met. Eating, clean clothes, safe shelter.
Mm-hmm.
That's the deal that I made with God that I think is love and kindness.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm being straight up with, because I was at the breaking point out here where my son was... One, I didn't have enough. I was working at Starbucks. I didn't have enough money to buy his. My wife, all three of us couldn't eat. So my wife was working at a hotel. She would eat in the cafeteria there. I would eat whatever muffins we marked down for the day, and so that we could afford the Similac formula for my son. And so I thought, I'm doing something wrong. Clearly, most men, they don't live like this. Mm-hmm. They go to work. They bring home a paycheck. Their wife either works or she doesn't. She brings home a paycheck or she doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Bills are paid. Food is bought. Some money is saved. Maybe a vacation every year. And that's how things are supposed to go. And I couldn't do that consistently.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing something wrong. And it goes back to the very first thing that we were talking about. Somehow, some way, I'll figure this out and I'll mm-hmm. make it right. And I couldn't. So I had to give it up. I had to give up the idea of what it meant to be a man. I had to give up my idea of what I thought money was.
Mm-hmm.
And what it could do for me, what a career was, and what it meant to me as a man, and just say, I don't know, but I'll make this deal with you, whoever or whatever is listening to me right now. If I can sleep indoors in a safe place, and my children are safe, and when they open the refrigerator, there's food there, and everyone has warm, clean clothes with no holes in it, I'll do whatever. Gratefully.
Right.
And 2 weeks after I made that deal, I got a job offer on a show. Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, my story about that is a little less profound. I made the decision to stop stealing music one day on iTunes, like, because you could get it on Napster or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I just made that decision, and I bought 20 songs, and later that day I stepped on a $20 bill.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Okay, it's not nearly as profound as your story, but it was weird.
You know what? I think a dollar is the same thing as $1 million. That's just my opinion.
What exactly do you mean?
I think if I treat $1 the same way that I would treat $1 million with respect.
Yeah.
That I can have either.
So you don't go below it when you, like, sell the pilot, clearly.
Well, again, I'm going to get corny here, but I think money is a way to be a service. You know, it's not my money. So, and again, I know it sounds... Now, that being said, I did buy a kit car that I had always... I had a poster of when I was a kid, and then I felt guilty for having it. I sold it.
Wait, what's it? Kit car is not the David Hasselhoff car.
No, although that would be pretty dope.
Yeah.
No, I had I had always wanted a 1967 Shelby 427 Cobra, but they're like $2 million, the real ones. But there are companies that make kit cars of them that are really great, and they're fast, and they're fun to drive. So this is how alcoholic I am. So I bought the car, and I had it for like 3 weeks, and I was like, man, I don't mind. It just fucking seems a little too flashy for me. So I sold it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man, I really missed that car. So I bought another one like it,
mm-hmm.
but I couldn't get it smogged out here because there's weird smog regulations in mm-hmm. California, so I sold it. And then, like, a year later, the guy that I had sold the first car to was like, hey, I'm selling the car. I'll sell it to you for exactly what you sold it to me for. Now, I had gotten it cheap when the economy shit the bed, so I just sold it to him for what I bought it for, just to pay it forward. And he goes, I'll sell it to you for what you sold it to me for. I was like, oh, that's cool. Get the car back. So I had the car for like 4 or 5 days, and a guy pulled up to me. He's like, hey, man, I'll give you cash for that car right now. And I go, fucking follow me home, man.
And I don't think that
the things that I like are eating when I'm hungry and knowing that my bills are going to be paid, and that there's ways for me to be of, you know, I can send shirts out all over the world for the podcast for people that are listening, and then get emails like I'm sure you get with like, man, I was really struggling and you had Danielle on. And I really, you know, I would forward her the messages that I would get from the podcast, and just, you know, that to me is like, oh, that's where the money should go. That's where the money should go, you know. So, or, you know, doing responsible shit like saving for the kids' college and saving for retirement and going out for a nice dinner every now and then. But it was never when I surrendered the idea of what money could be or what a career could be and come from it from a service point of view, then my ego's out of it and then I don't need anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Wow. I was just thinking how I don't know at what impact the guests that I interview on this podcast have on me, because you know how information comes in and you don't know what your subconscious is doing with it.
Yeah.
So I just had this moment of gratitude. That happened. But okay, we gotta sign off. We talked before we started recording. You're 13 years sober, is that right?
12 and a half. Yeah.
12 and a half. And I mean, what's there to say about that except that it's done miracles for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I had always felt like I never had the rule book.
Yeah.
You know, and if for whatever reason, it felt like once I got sober and I started taking some actions, some suggested direction that originated from a principle-oriented place, you know, just do this. You don't need to know why. You need to know how.
Yeah.
And I'd always wanted to know why, because unbeknownst to myself, when I'm going down the why path, there's a lot of great self-rationalization, and I can confuse myself, and I'm looking, really, when I'm wondering why, I'm just looking for a reason to not.
Yeah.
Fill in the blank. To not do, to not, you know. But when you say how, you know, it's like reading a workout book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you read it over and over and over again, and you go, I've read this thing 100 times and I'm still fat. I don't understand.
Right.
Well, then when you start doing the shit it says in the book, that's when your life changes. That's when your body's going to change, right? So I wanted to apply that same principle to what actions can I take in my life to change my thinking?
Yeah.
And I never thought that I could do that before. It never occurred to me that my thinking might be corrupt.
Yeah.
That my instincts that had allowed me to survive my entire life might now be doing the exact opposite of what they should. It's not self-preservation anymore. It's self-destruction.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to me that that could be the case, which is a profound shift in my understanding of who I was, you know?
Yeah, but I wonder if realizing that drinking is like that first, you know, the great solution turned to the great destroyer.
It was my best friend. I mean, I fucking loved drinking. I'd be drunk right now if I'd get away with it.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, I'd be drinking if I could. But it just doesn't work for me anymore.
Yeah. Well, that's a great note to end on. It's so, like, it's such a button, kind of. But thank you.
Really nice hanging with you.
At least I don't lie to you guys. That was a crazy, crazy story. Yeah, that was Nick Betancourt on After Party Pod. And go listen to his podcast. And thank you for listening. See you next time.